From the Watson Institute at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Sarah Baldwin. This is a very special episode of Trending Globally, and not just because I got to talk with author and Watson Senior Fellow Stephen Kinzer about secret agents and mind-altering drugs. It's also special because it's our 100th episode. Our producers and I and everyone here just wanted to say thanks to all of you for listening and to all our guests who have made these 100 episodes so fun and enlightening. Here's to many more. And boy, do we have a good one today. I talked with Stephen about his newest book, Poisoner in Chief, Sidney Gottlieb and the CIA's Search for Mind Control. Gottlieb was the head of MKUltra, a top-secret CIA project in the 50s and 60s that wanted to learn how to control the human mind. He ran sinister experiments on human subjects across the globe, and in the process, helped spread the use of psychedelic drugs like LSD. It's one of those stories that if it weren't true, you'd never believe it. But it is. Stephen Kinzer, thank you so much for coming in today to talk about Poisoner in Chief.
It's always great to be with you, Sarah.
As I was preparing for this podcast, I felt a little guilty because I was having so much fun. It didn't feel like work, but it was also uncomfortable because of the nature of the content. Could you start off by reading the epigraph that you chose?
I've been a lifelong Shakespeare fan, and of course there's a Shakespeare epigram for every occasion. So I took this piece from Julius Caesar. It's a dialogue between two of the conspirators who are trying to decide whether they should get involved in killing Caesar. And it's Ligarius and Brutus. This is their dialogue. What's to do? A piece of work that will make sick men whole. But are not some whole that we must make sick? That must we also.
It's perfect for the topic of your book, Sidney Gottlieb, and what he got up to for a decade, seemingly with zero accountability. But let's just start at the beginning. Who was Sidney Gottlieb? And how did he sort of gain these epithets, Dr. Death, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Poisoner in Chief?
I have to say that this is my 10th book, and over the course of trying to discover what goes on behind the facade of public diplomacy and public policy that we see, I've come up with a lot of things that are surprising. Some of them may have shocked some people, but this is the first time I've been shocked. I'm still trying to process everything that I discovered in writing this book. I can't believe that this MKUltra mind control project run by the CIA actually existed.
Well, take us back to the 1950s, pre-MKUltra, and the sort of apocalyptic existential dread in the United States, post-World War II, the Soviet Union, Red China.
In the early Cold War, Americans were given a narrative and made to believe that we faced a hateful, diabolical enemy that was plotting to wipe out not only our country and our way of life, but the entire possibility of meaningful life on Earth. In a climate like that, almost everything seems justifiable as a defensive measure. In that climate, a project like MKUltra, which would involve the sacrificing of innocent lives, maybe even hundreds of lives, would have seemed eminently justifiable. And to complain about the loss of a few hundred lives in the context of a conflict that threatened to wipe away all of civilization would have seemed naive and sentimental. That was the climate in which MKUltra was launched and Sidney Gottlieb began his work.
So Sidney Gottlieb is this kid in the Bronx. He's really good at chemistry. He goes to Arkansas Tech, I believe, and studies the principles of dairying and is going into agricultural biology, I think, and then ends up getting a PhD in biochemistry from Caltech. And then what made him, the CIA didn't even exist at that point. It was born in what, 1945?
1949.
So meanwhile, tell us about Kurt Blome and Shiro Ishii.
As the CIA chemists and their predecessors in the immediate post-war period began to reflect on the possibility of a mind control program. With a scientist's mind, they decided to look first of all for existing research. They asked themselves, so who's out there that already knows how to destroy a human mind or a human body or a human soul? That would presumably be the first step toward mind control. Before you can insert a new mind into someone's brain, you first have to destroy the brain that's in there. So they looked around the world, and here we are in the late 40s and early 50s. Who were the people with experience in conducting diabolical and fatal experiments aimed at finding techniques by which people could control other people? The Nazi doctors who had worked in the concentration camps, plus their Japanese counterparts, who under this General Shiro Ishii had carried out some experiments that were even more gruesome than those carried out at the Nazi concentration camps. So the CIA decided to bring these people in to the early planning of its own mind control program. In the course of my research for this book, I visited what I think might be the first CIA secret prison in Germany. It's in a beautiful chalet. There, I was shown these rooms, and the person who owns the house now said to me very matter-of-factly, these were the cells where the CIA doctors and chemists, along with their Nazi partners, carried out those horrible experiments that were actually just continuations of the experiments that these Nazi doctors had conducted only a few years earlier at concentration camps right down the road.
But these techniques were torture and interrogation techniques meant to break someone's spirit, right? This was not quite chemical solutions, was it?
The chemicals were used as a way to try to break people's resistance.
So THC, cocaine, heroin.
They went through the entire list of drugs, and by the time Gottlieb came on, of course, he became fascinated with LSD. All of these experiments were aimed at finding a way to give the CIA the power to control people's minds. And 10 years of experiments, which definitely destroyed the minds of an unknown number of human beings and resulted in an unknown number of deaths, all were aimed at this goal, which ultimately I think Gottlieb concluded he was successful at, and that is, can you destroy a person's mind with enough drugs and electroshock and all other techniques? He found out the answer was yes. Unfortunately, he also concluded after 10 years that it's not possible to implant another mind into the resulting void. There is no way, in essence, to make a person go out and commit murder if that person is fundamentally opposed to committing murder. Gottlieb, in the end, was forced to conclude that mind control is a myth, and but he left quite a trail behind him.
Let's talk about that trail, because those were real people that they considered expendables. Who were the people in the U.S., in Germany, in the Philippines, who were these people who were given crazy amounts of LSD for crazy amounts of time?
Gottlieb had experiments inside the United States and outside the United States. So within the U.S., the favorite MK Ultra subjects were prisoners, for obvious reasons. I find in this book one experiment, for example, at a prison in Kentucky, in which seven African-American inmates were segregated and, without being told what was happening to them, given triple doses of LSD every day for 77 days. That was aimed at trying to figure out if that kind of an overdose could destroy a person's mind. And I guess the answer is obvious. The answer is yes, it can. Later on, I came to wonder what happened to those seven guys.
Because they didn't die.
They didn't die in that experiment, but what about their future lives? We don't even know their names because the records were all destroyed. I suspect that they may have lived their whole lives and ultimately died without ever realizing what had happened to them, much less that they were part of a CIA experiment. Abroad, Gottlieb's experiments were even more intense because there he didn't have what was charmingly called the disposal problem. If some people were experimented to death, their bodies could simply be disposed of. Gottlieb had effectively the right to requisition human subjects at will from CIA and Army intelligence in Europe and in East Asia. And if those subjects died, that was okay because they were, as you mentioned, expendables. So who were they? In Europe, many of them were captured suspected enemy agents that had fallen into CIA hands or refugees about whom it was thought that nobody would miss them if they never turned up again. In East Asia, many of these subjects were captured North Korean prisoners of war. All of them were destined to become subjects in what were the most extreme experiments ever conducted on human beings by any agency or official of the U.S. government.
What did people die of who were given, you know, massive amounts of LSD?
I don't think anybody who was given massive amounts of LSD ever died. However, Gottlieb was experimenting with a variety of poisons and trying to find out what was the level that you could push a person to before he died. And oftentimes these toxins were applied in conjunction with electroshock, combinations of amphetamines and barbiturates, and other potions that Gottlieb concocted. He was definitely the greatest expert on poisons in the United States, probably in the world. He was so fascinated with LSD, and by his own account, took it more than 200 times himself. It made me wonder, since the experiments he came up with were so bizarre and so diabolically creative, did he conceive some of them while he was actually tripping on acid?
That's an interesting thought. Wow. Also, can we just pause a moment and talk about the names of these CIA operations? They're sort of fantastical, but also creepily innocent sounding, like Operation Paperclip, Operation Bluebird, Operation Artichoke.
So Operation Paperclip was the operation directed by American intelligence agents after World War II that was aimed at bringing Nazi scientists and then later Nazi spies and then after that Nazi doctors and chemists into the United States or into the service of U.S. agencies. The paperclip operatives were involved in what was called bleaching. So they would bleach the resumes of former Nazis and eliminate all references to membership in the Gestapo or the SS or involvement in forced labor and add references to their family lives and so forth. Later on, when the CIA launched its mind control program, the first name was Bluebird. Apparently, this was because one of the original goals of the CIA chemical program was to find a truth serum, something you could use on prisoners. And at one early meeting, one of the officers said that what we were looking for was something that would make a prisoner sing like a bird. Later on, Alan Dulles changed the name of Bluebird to Operation Artichoke. Again, that was the CIA mind control program. I read somewhere that that was his favorite vegetable. I'm not sure. There was also a famous gangster during a little earlier period named the Artichoke King in New York, so some people speculate that might have been it. But the most important name was the one Alan Dulles came up with for this program as it reached maturity. He called the CIA search for mind control MK Ultra. He believed, and he probably was right, that this was the ultra program of the whole CIA. If the CIA could find the key to mind control and be able to direct the conduct of people around the world, the prize would be nothing less than global mastery. Other CIA successes of the early 1950s, like overthrowing the government of Guatemala or overthrowing the government of Iran, would pale into insignificance. That's why Dulles named this program MK Ultra and named this most unlikely figure, Sidney Gottlieb, to direct it.
I want to talk about Gottlieb in a little bit and Dulles, but just speaking of gangsters, just to give us a taste of how surreal, in my view, this operation became. Can you tell us a little bit about George Hunter White?
George Hunter White is one of the wilder characters in this book. So as I said, Gottlieb was experimenting in his own mind with every different permutation of techniques and potions that might make people speak more freely. And at one point he decided he'd like to see if the combination of sex and drugs would be enough to make men speak freely and say things they might not otherwise say. So he came up with the idea of opening a bordello in San Francisco. He rented an apartment at 225 Chestnut Street on Telegraph Hill. And the idea was that prostitutes would invite men back to this apartment, and there their drinks would be spiked with either LSD or whatever drug Gottlieb was interested in that week. To run this operation, Gottlieb selected this federal narcotics agent named George Hunter White, who had been a veteran of the wars against jazz in New York City and famously persecuted Billie Holiday. So George Hunter White set up this bordello, arranged for the prostitutes to bring their men there, and would spend his evenings watching the proceedings from behind a one-way mirror while sitting on his portable toilet and drinking martinis out of a pitcher and making little notes about how the men were behaving. That was the level of clinical rigor with which these experiments were carried out. And at the CIA, this operation was called Operation Midnight Climax. It was the CIA's way of using your tax dollars to defend Americans against the threat of communism.
It's surreal, if not insane. I mean, but I guess it made sense to them at the time, or they made it make sense to themselves. And just going back to Gottlieb's predilection for sort of investigating the effects of poisons on human beings, and your epithet, poisoner in chief, talk a little bit about what else his job entailed.
After 10 years running MKUltra, as I mentioned earlier, Gottlieb was forced to conclude that essentially the search for mind control had failed, and the reason for that was that mind control doesn't exist. Nonetheless, Gottlieb had established himself as the expert in poisons at the CIA. Therefore, when in May of 1960, President Eisenhower told Alan Dulles, the director of the CIA, that he wanted Fidel Castro, as he put it, sawed off, ultimately the job went to Sidney Gottlieb. Gottlieb was the person who made all those poisons you may have read about that were aimed at killing Fidel Castro. He's the one who poisoned the 50 Cohiba cigars that were supposed to be handed to Castro. And they turned out to have been so strongly poisoned that you wouldn't even have to light one. You could just put it in your mouth and you would instantly die. He also crafted several envelopes full of L pills, as they were charmingly called. So L stands for lethal, pills that would kill you if they were dropped into your drink or mixed into your food. He even made a wetsuit that was supposed to be given to Fidel Castro, and it was tainted on the inside with a fungus that was going to eat away Castro's skin and kill him if he put it on. Later that summer, Eisenhower ordered the assassination of another foreign leader. That was Patrice Lumumba, the prime minister of the Congo. In that case, Gottlieb not only made poison and all the accoutrements to deliver the poison, but he carried this little kit that he made from Washington to the Congo and delivered it to the CIA station chief.
What did the kit contain?
It had a vial of Gottlieb's favorite poison called botulinum. It also contained another device that Gottlieb had created. It was a hypodermic needle with a very strong, but still a very extremely thin needle. So you could stick somebody in the thigh with this needle, and it was so thin, the person wouldn't even feel that there'd been anything amiss. Gottlieb had developed this device as a way of poisoning wine bottles through the cork because the hole that it made was so minuscule nobody could notice it. So he put one of these hypodermic syringes in the kit, plus some chlorine, a mask, some gloves, the entire kit you would need. This definitely makes him the only person in American history ever to carry government-made poison from Washington to another country with the purpose of using that poison to assassinate the leader of that country.
That we know of.
You know, I think maybe my favorite line in my book comes at the very end when I say, everything in this book is true, but not everything that's true is in this book. I'm painfully aware that I've only discovered a portion of what MKUltra was and what Sidney Gottlieb did. This process of research, however, has to lead you to ask yourself if such a person could exist. And I really do think I stumbled on the most powerful unknown American of the 20th century. Who is existing now, doing things that we're not even imagining? Technology is so much further advanced, and ambitions and perceptions of threats are so much more elaborately involved that it would be naive to think that something like this could have happened decades ago, but wouldn't happen now.
I want to revisit that thought about today in a little bit. But I want to stay with this person, Sidney Gottlieb, for a minute, because I just don't know how to make sense of him. I understand patriotism. I can understand commitment to a cause. But this is a son of Jewish immigrants whose parents might have been the victims of the people he then worked with. And somehow, besides the fact that he wrote poetry and lived in the woods and had goats and chickens and meditated and was an all-around gentleman who then went off to work with lepers in India. Besides that, it's hard for me to understand how day after day, for I guess the rest of his life, he made sense of what he was doing.
Commitment to a great cause is the ultimate justification for committing immoral acts. Patriotism is among the most transcendent and seductive of causes. That's a lesson I also think that Gottlieb has for us today. You never want to lose sight of that moral equation that asks whether there isn't some amount of evil that you can do pursuing what you think is a good cause before the evil begins to outweigh the goodness of the cause. He was such a contradictory person. He was a creative visionary, but he was also horrifically destructive. In many ways, he was an outlaw, but he was also an outlaw in the service of power. He was the most prolific torturer of his generation, but he was a very gentle-hearted torturer. All of these contradictory archetypes flow into this complicated person. At the end of his life, as I describe in my book, he seemed to be haunted by his past. Anybody who believes in final judgment or karmic payback would have to be troubled to look back on a life like Gottlieb's. And by all accounts, he did fall victim to that and had considerable difficulty in later life in his inner efforts to confront his past.
Yeah, I was just surprised at, you know, this man was cloaked in secrecy and anonymity, but you got access to such an interesting array of sources, including from the CIA.
When Gottlieb was leaving the CIA in 1973, he and his mentor, Richard Helms, who was also leaving at that time, agreed that they had to destroy all the records of MKUltra. And Gottlieb himself went out to the CIA Record Center and supervised the destruction of 7 crates of documents. With that, an irreplaceable archive was lost. Nonetheless, it later turned out that there was another cache of documents that were expense account reports that described a number of these sub-projects, as Gottlieb called them. In addition, the diary of this drug agent, George Hunter White, who supervised Operation Midnight Climax in San Francisco, turned up in an obscure community college south of San Francisco.
I'd love you to read a quote by him. Can you just read this excerpt from George Hunter White's diary?
In that diary, we found a nice copy of a note that he had sent to Sidney Gottlieb when he retired, when they parted company. So George Hunter White wrote to Gottlieb, "I was a very minor missionary, actually a heretic. But I toiled wholeheartedly in the vineyards because it was fun, fun, fun. Where else could a red-blooded American boy lie, kill, cheat, steal, rape, and pillage with the sanction and blessing of the All-Highest? Pretty good stuff, brother." So this diary produced some interesting insights. It was delightfully indiscreet. I also discovered that although Gottlieb never committed any of his thoughts to paper, his wife wrote a number of letters to her family. Her father had been a prominent Presbyterian missionary and at the end of his life donated his papers to the Presbyterian Archive in Philadelphia. In those papers were a number of letters from Sidney Gottlieb's wife describing their life together. So I had a lot of fun in the Presbyterian Archive. And I also came up with interviews with some interesting people who had crossed paths with Gottlieb or the family in various ways. So I've tried to piece together as best I could a story that Gottlieb certainly hoped would never be told.
Is there a lesson that we should draw from this story?
In the early 50s, when Gottlieb was carrying out his experiments, the Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, made a famous remark that there was only once every 1,000 years that a moment of crisis like this comes, and not since the Muslims had sought to invade Iberia 1,000 years ago had the world confronted a threat like communism. If you believe that, then I guess you're a willing tool for almost any defensive mechanism. Now, again, we're being told that we have so many threats, we have to do things we might not otherwise do. I hope we don't fall into the same moral trap into which Gottlieb fell. That's the trap that tells us that although we're essentially good and decent all the time, we right now have to be in a moment where we leave that decency behind and do things that are necessary for our survival. Threat inflation is a natural impulse in many people's psyches, and I think we have to be careful not to fall for that. Let's understand that moments pass, history continues to unfold, and it's dangerous to look at the moment you're living in as the one that is so defined by horrific threats that normal ethics and morality no longer have a place in your daily calculations.
Well, that's sage counsel. Thank you so much, Stephen, for writing this book and for sharing this story with us and for coming in today to talk to us about it.
Always good to be with you. Thanks.
This episode of Trending Globally was produced by Dan Richards and Babette Thomas. Our theme music is by Henry Bloomfield. I'm Sarah Baldwin. Thanks again to all our listeners. We would not be at this 100th episode without you. We're looking forward to 100 more. If you haven't yet, please leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps others find the show. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Spread the word. We'd really appreciate it. For more information about this and other shows, go to watson.brown.edu. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for another episode of Trending Globally.